When you visit Arizona, time is measured in moments, not minutes. Like the moment you see the Grand Canyon for the first time. Visit a new state of mind. Learn more at hereyouareaz.com.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
This is Smarter Collaboration, the series that shows people of dissimilar skills coming together to create something new and breakthrough. Today, our hosts, Dr. Heidi Gardner and Ivan Matviak, meet Cynthia Round, who spent her career in marketing and brand building with companies like Procter & Gamble, but she spent them with corporations and also with nonprofits. This is an exclusive, in-depth look at collaboration within world-class organizations like the United Way and the Met. And just listen to how collaboration can lead to empowered people to execute on their particular vision and mission. Here's Heidi, Ivan, and Cynthia. Enjoy.
We're thrilled to welcome Cynthia Round to the podcast. Cynthia is a brand strategist who focuses on revitalizing nonprofit and cultural brands and building relevance to new audiences. She's led marketing at the Metropolitan Museum of Art, one of New York City's most visited tourist attractions, and the United Way Worldwide, one of the world's largest privately funded nonprofits. Previously, Cynthia built global brands at our former employer, Procter & Gamble, as well as at Ogilvy & Mather. Collaboration has been an important part of her career successes, as well as her work on nonprofit boards, including the Advertising Educational Foundation.
Welcome, Cynthia. We're glad to have you with us.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Great. Well, let's jump right in. It's an amazing background, both in the corporate world and in the nonprofit world. I would love to get your perspective on how collaboration is different in those two environments.
I spent roughly the first half of my career in the corporate world and then the second half in the nonprofit sector. And I don't actually think that collaboration is all that different in the two worlds. You have the same kind of challenges in both, you know, where time is a limited resource, where you need to get your share of budget to be able to do your work, and where, of course, everybody wants to get acknowledgement and recognition for the contribution that they're making. So those things you have in common. I think it's possible that in my experience in the nonprofit sector, because people come together there truly motivated by purpose and mission, that collaboration may come a little more naturally. These are people who've already kind of given up. They've made some decisions to give up some financial gains that they might have personally made and some other things. And so the fact that they're drawn together by trying to create some positive change or do something positive in the world, I think might make, you know, nonprofit people slightly more collaborative.
That's interesting. I mean, as I'm listening to you, I'm thinking, okay, so people aren't competing for the monetary rewards, but I wonder if there's other kinds of resources that they're competing for, or potentially even for recognition.
Yes, I think both of those, as I said, I think those are the things that they share in common. They still want recognition and acknowledgement for the contributions that they're making. And there's still a budget that's got to be one budget pie every year that's got to be split into each department. And so whatever your particular area is, in my case, you know, marketing and brand building, you know, you're still trying to attract the resources that you think you need to do your job. But I'm just saying that I think that in my experience, there's sort of less of the kind of holding, you know, my toys and protecting them. There's a more openness because, in fact, most of the work requires not just collaboration inside the organization, but it requires collaboration, you know, often in the case, for example, of United Way. I mean, it's collaboration with business, with the government, with the community at large, with other nonprofits. The work doesn't happen as a solo actor. It happens in collaboration, in community. So I think that that is, you know, part of what it makes the dynamic a little bit different. And again, I'm not saying it makes it collaboration easier, but I just think it makes it a little bit more a natural part. It's one of the tools that you just absolutely have to have and you have to use to be successful.
Yeah, absolutely. I wonder whether trust is a little different there as well. You know, in the book, we write about how important trust is to effective collaboration. And, you know, when you have people who have decided to join a nonprofit where their goals and perhaps their values might be aligned, I wonder if that helps increase trust amongst people.
Yeah, I think it probably does. As you said, it's a little bit, it's kind of hardwired into it. And I would say, you know, trust is the bedrock, not only of the work at the nonprofit, but it's the trust of all relationships, right? So I would say trust is even the core to successful branding, right? I mean, you've got to create and build trust. So it's sort of, to me, trust is like the table stakes, you know, for any success in the various jobs that I've had across my career, whether that was the corporate world or the nonprofit sector.
Makes total sense. And, you know, you touched on something that I think is absolutely foundational to what we call smarter collaboration, which is getting different actors, whether those are individuals or whole sectors of the economy working together. And you mentioned at the United Way, it was government and businesses and communities and so forth. Where do you think some of the biggest successes were? You know, how do you unpack where that really came together? Why did it work so well? And what can other leaders learn from getting those very disparate groups together?
Well, I think that certainly is an interesting question. I mean, I would say that one of the probably biggest successes when I look back on my United Way career, and I was at United Way Worldwide for 12 years, and, you know, it's 1,700 independent local United Ways and independent communities across 40 countries. And so the idea of kind of unifying and collaborating is central to that. And early in my tenure, the leadership team that I was working with, the CEO, under the leadership of Brian Gallagher, really questioned the core business plan, the business strategy of United Way. The longstanding kind of community chest fundraiser fund distributor model was sort of called into question because we were still raising $4 billion a year globally and American philanthropy was increasing and yet our social problems weren't getting any better. And so it caused us to kind of define the business as not so much fundraising and fund distribution, but really community change. And so once we made that switch, the idea that community change was what we were all about, what United Way was about and was what it was going to lead, that again required collaboration. You don't improve graduation rates among young people or financial stability among families or health access to healthcare as a singular nonprofit, right? You're doing that in collaboration with school systems, with the public sector and with everyone. So I think what United Way learned was the importance of convening the players early on, you know, that people support what they have a hand in building, right? So United Way was trying to set goals and strategies around change, but we couldn't do that on our own. It required engaging the community and not just getting buy-in, but getting all the ideas. How are we going to do this? How are we going to move the needle on these intractable systemic challenges? And so I think, again, the important lessons were around the, you know, getting people to sign on to a common vision, having metrics and goals that you would measure and that you would hold yourselves collectively accountable to. The idea, again, as I said, that people have a hand in building, when they have a hand in building something, they're far more likely to support it. And then really it's about inspiring and empowering all the players to do their piece, because whether that's individuals inside an organization or whether it's across a community, everyone's going to have their own role, right? And so you've got to find a way to inspire and empower everyone against that common vision, toward that common vision, and toward the willingness to be, as I said, hold yourselves mutually accountable to a set of metrics, of quantifiable metrics of change.
That makes complete sense. And you know, as we're talking often to very senior leaders and CEOs and so forth of purpose-driven organizations, there's this very tough balancing act of setting those long-term goals, because anything meaningful takes real time. And you just mentioned 10-year goals. But how do you keep people focused on those long-term ambitious goals while at the same time making sure that they hit some of those shorter term metrics to give you confidence that you're actually staying on track?
Well, you know, I think that's a common challenge also in the business world, right? Or in our brand management marketing world at Procter. I mean, you have the marketing brand people who are thinking long term about the consumer market share, and then you've got the sales department that's got to make the quarterly sales goals. And there's something in the dynamic tension of that long term, short term, right, that actually drives the organization forward, drives the brand forward, drives the business forward. And I think that's the same thing in the nonprofit sector. And if you're looking at the short-term wins, because that encourages people, it also those are the indicators that you're on the right path. So at United Way, I'm still working with United Way Metropolitan Dallas, and we just released our latest community impact report. Every year, we put out a report against what's the progress on the 10-year goal, so that it keeps everybody focused on where we're falling short, where we're exceeding. And one of the things that I always like to say about, you know, this kind of these grand, you know, BHAGs, right, these big, ambitious, bold goals, is that we will get further in 10 years because we set those ambitious goals than we would have without it, right? And so on some level, it's okay if we miss the goal, because we will have achieved so much more together because we were trying to get there. And so the idea that you're measuring, constantly measuring and sharing out the successes and the credit for what has going well, while also acknowledging that there are still gaps and there's still so much work to do. Both the successes and the gaps are motivating to donors, to staff, to the community, right? To say, okay, we're making progress, but we've still got a long ways to go.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Cynthia, let's maybe pivot for a moment to one of the other amazing nonprofits that you've worked with, the Met. In our book, we talk about the importance of bringing together people with very different backgrounds and perspectives and life experiences so that they can contribute their unique perspectives and foster more debate and discussion. I'd be interested to hear how that kind of cross-silo collaboration happened at the Metropolitan Museum of Art.
Well, the Met is a wonderful example of what you're saying, and of cultural institutions which are comprised of people that are from very diverse perspectives, educational backgrounds, and even their purposes for being there. Right? I mean, you've got, in the case of the Met, you've got the PhD scholar art historians who are the protectors and preservers of the collection. They study the collection, they write about it, they present it. And in many ways, their primary interest is their own academic community, right? I mean, they care very much about that. Then you've got the rest of the museum, which is there to try to serve the public, to try to, you know, everything from the retail operation to the restaurants to visitor services and the security guards, not to mention those folks like myself who were in marketing or the fundraiser and others who are trying to generate the resources to keep the enterprise going, right? And so you're so right that there were very different kinds of perspectives. But the goal, the reason they brought me in, I was the first consumer marketing person brought into the Met, and that was 10 years ago. And at that time, kind of brand thinking in cultural institutions, I like to express that they were a little bit allergic to the idea of brands. They, you know, didn't feel like see why they would need that. They were already an incredibly successful institution, the largest museum in the U.S., you know, the most tourist the biggest tourist attraction in New York City. I mean, they were very successful, but like so many cultural institutions, had found themselves becoming increasingly elite and appealing to a narrower, a more and more narrow audience, like so many other cultural institutions, you know, the opera, the symphony, the theater, appealing to a better educated, higher socioeconomic group. When in the case of the Met, the whole reason it exists, it was created 150 years ago, was to educate and inspire the public through art, right? So it was a public mission and a nonprofit goal. And so in that case, they brought me in to try to become a more open and accessible institution. And I would say, you know, back to the lessons I was talking earlier, the first thing was to get everyone aligned around that as a shared goal. Could we all get on the same page about the fact that being a more open, accessible institution was not going to dumb down the art? It was not going to mean that we were less scholarly, but it would mean that we would be more true to the inherent mission of the organization. So that idea of aligning around the mission, of then engaging people throughout the process. We brought in cultural anthropologists who did an ethnographic study. And I shared that with everyone. All 2,200 staff came together. We presented the work. We had these, you know, cultural anthropologists talking about observing and chatting with people and sharing the insights. And so as we went along and created the strategy, people knew what was happening, where it was going. And then the most important one, again, was about inspiring and empowering each of them to the lead from the seat that they sat in creating this kind of shared vision of a more open, accessible museum. What that meant for a security guard: you're not just there to protect the art, but you're the directors of first impressions. You're the people that, you know, check the bags and people decide from the first moment whether or not this is a welcoming place that people want, you know, where they as individuals are welcome and wanted, that kind of thing. So again, I think the trick was the secret to success was engagement throughout, involvement around a common vision, and then really empowering people to lead in their own way against that vision.
I mean, that's fascinating. When, you know, so often we encountered examples as we were researching for our latest book, times when people would convene a very diverse group of people for a project, an initiative, a restructure, you name it, and then really not use all of those different perspectives and inputs. You know, we ended up writing a chapter called The Illusion of Inclusion, because it was sort of fake inclusion, right? It was having people in the room because you wanted to be able to say that we had this type of person or that type of background. But if you didn't create the environment where people, to your word, were empowered to actually do something about it, what's the point? It could almost backfire and create cynicism. So I'm wondering, you know, if you have any recollection of what it took to get all of those different people on board. How did you convince a security guard that they were a vital part of the institution? And how did you really truly empower them so that they could play their role to the fullest?
Well, I think, you know, again, part of it was sharing, being completely open, the kind of open kimono, right? Like, there are no secrets. We're sharing everything and we're doing it in real time as we go. So this was a process of a couple of years, and we shared things all along the way and took questions and invited everyone in and talked about it throughout the process. And so, again, that was certainly a piece of it. But I think, it comes out of true respect. I mean, we knew we couldn't create a more open, accessible experience for people at the Met unless everyone was engaged and involved. So success required collaboration. It required us to learn where were the rough spots. Where was there dissonance? Where was there someone who was resisting this idea? Because we couldn't succeed if the security guard was going to rough you up when you walked in the door, checking your bag, right? If you felt like you weren't, you know, that they were staring at you like you didn't belong there, then you know, it was not going to be an open experience from the get-go. The same thing is true, you know, of of even how we did wall labels and convincing and talking with the curators about how do we tell the stories of art? What stories need to be told that will actually engage more people and help them feel part of this and see this as part of their life story? We started defining art as, you know, humanity's story. That's what it is. I mean, there was one man in our focus groups who said that the thing he loved about being at the Met was that he could place himself in the stream of humanity when he was there. And I would hold that up and say to our curators, that's what you do to people. You're the way you, and the way you tell the stories of art help people place themselves in the stream of humanity. And so that kind of, you know, sharing of those anecdotes, but also making it vivid and real. And as I said, truly respecting the diverse opinions and experiences and working with that and through that, I think was the most important thing because success required it.
Yeah, absolutely. I love that, that visual of a stream of humanity walking through the doors of the Met every day. You know, what you do from a marketing point of view obviously requires enormous creativity. And you talked about, you know, getting people from all different roles within the Met involved. I'd be really interested to hear how collaboration has helped inject more creativity into the campaigns or other you know, initiatives that you've worked on in your career.
Well, first, I would say that I feel like a brand strategist and marketer is a professional collaborator by definition, because I define, you know, I start from the point of view, and I think all great brands understand this, that we don't own our brands, we co-own them with the users. So by definition, you've got a collaboration right there, right? I mean, it's the users that give our brands value. A brand is really, I define a brand as a relationship. So if it's a relationship, it is a collaboration. Our aim is to find out how are we significant in the lives of that, of our loyal users. How is this brand significant in the lives of these loyal users? That was true whether I was a Pampers brand manager in Italy, the Dove, you know, leading the Dove advertising at Ogilvy, or at the Met. The goal was always how to be significant somehow in the lives of our loyal users. So that define that to me, that is collaboration first with the consumer, right? With the object of your advertising, the brand, you're trying to build a brand, you're building that collaboration. And then because it's about so much more than perception, it's about so much more than just consistent messaging. It is about an experience, a total immersive experience we're trying to create for a brand. Again, in every situation that I can think of, every brand I've ever worked on, whether that was inside the company as an advertising advisor, inside the nonprofit, or now as a consultant, you're always collaborating to try to create this fully rounded experience that requires the engagement of everyone who would touch that brand or that brand experience. So to me, it's branding is the definition. Collaboration is so much at the heart of it that if you don't consider yourself willing or able to collaborate first with the consumer and then with all of your colleagues, you're not going to be able to be successful. So the best ideas come from the consumers, from the focus groups, from listening, from active listening, right? From a marketing point of view, the execution of those come from respecting and understanding the people who are in creating the retail environment, who are creating the social media, who are you know, creating the packaging. I mean, all of it comes together to work to build a successful brand and a successful brand experience. So collaboration has been at the heart of virtually any brand that I've had the privilege to work on.
Yeah. I'm curious whether there's a particular instance that comes to mind, Cynthia, where collaboration led to something really novel or unexpected.
Well, one of my favorite examples from the Met was around this thinking. We were trying to figure out, if you're trying to be open and accessible to people from all walks of life, one of the questions I posed is, how can we make art as important to everyday life as music is? right? Mm-hmm. We all think about music, we listen to it all the time, but art doesn't seem to play quite as central a role in our everyday lives. And so with that kind of as a thought starter, we began a collaboration with the education department, and we said, you know, we're trying to attract more young people. So they had this idea that we would create this notion of teens, a teen nine, and we called it Teens Take the Met. Like, take the Met, use it, we want to bring you and we want you. And it became a collaboration not only internally for 3 hours, bringing in young people, middle school and high school students, New York City from all the five boroughs. But we also had to collaborate with the school system. The city council provided buses. And then we collaborated with 40 different public, other public cultural institutions to come up and set up shop in the Met that night. And that was everyone from other museums to the Intrepid to the Empire State Building, I mean, all the various things to say, these are the kind of ways young people could be involved with the cultural life of New York City. And so that to me was an idea that came out of collaboration first with a department around an idea, then with the city, and then with other cultural institutions. And it created something that was so successful when we launched it. That 10 years later, they're still doing it. They do it every year. In fact, they're doing it twice a year. And it's something that that is not only a successful evening, but I think about all those young people who've now been introduced to art, not through, you know, a field trip with their teachers, but with their friends one night when the museum was all about them. And we know that museum going culture is started when you're young. You know, it's like a young person. If you start going when you're a young person, you're going to keep it up as a life habit. So I think about all those young people who've now been exposed to art in new ways. And the fact that this Teens Take the Met is a concept, an idea that has taken on a life of its own and has grown so much bigger than, you know, this from this germ of this idea of how do we make art as important to everybody's life. What one anecdote I'll tell you is that first night we were doing video interviews of some of the young people, and a couple of girls were saying, "This is so cool. Tonight everybody is at the Met. Even the bad boys that skip class and smoke under the stairs are here tonight." So I thought that was a mark of true success. We had attracted the bad boys who skipped school, and they were at the Met that night.
That's wow, that is a real mark of success.
Hopefully they weren't smoking too near the art.
That's when you need those security guards to play the right role, right?
Exactly.
But as I'm listening to you, Cynthia, you know, one thing that occurs to me is I suspect there were a number of people who had to get past their own ego to make this work. Right. I mean, the Met is the Met. Right. I mean, it has all these associations with it, and somehow coming to terms with the need to do things differently is implicitly a nod of, you know, times changing and the evolution that's required. Did you find that there were resistors to making these changes? What did that look like, and how did you deal with it?
Well, there certainly was. Initially some resistance. As I said, a decade ago when I started this work with cultural institutions, a lot of them were kind of allergic to the whole idea of branding, and that was what I was always brought in to do, right? So I kind of knew I was going to face resistance in a lot of, you know, in a lot of these ways initially. So I kind of anticipate and expect it. I actually think that the main way to overcome that is to have a true personal curiosity about other people and their experiences. I don't mean a fake curiosity. I don't mean asking questions, as you said, kind of a faux engagement, you know, or an engagement where you kind of bring people in and you pretend that you're listening or collaborating. But if you genuinely are curious about what other people think, and you respect that they're bringing something important to the experience. And again, all this starts from if you've already established a common vision and you're trying to work towards that together, then the importance of engaging those diverse perspectives and voices and understanding what challenges you're going to have and executing or realizing that, then you sort of go in toward the tension. You don't go away from the tension. You move into it and you actually work with it and you work through it. And so, you know, the example I don't recall specifically, but I imagine when we first called the city council in New York City and said, you know, can you provide buses for all New York City school kids to come? That probably wasn't an immediate, yes, that's an obviously great idea, right? Sure. Why not? And internally, I've probably glossed over this in my own memory, but I mean, I doubt that the 17 curatorial heads were, when I said we're going to bring teenagers in for 3 hours and turn the museum over to them on Friday night, there were probably one or two that said, can we talk about that? And so, you know, so I think it comes out of respect and curiosity, honestly, those are personal characteristics. And then those become kind of department characteristics, right? Like you can embed those as values into the department, into the institution, into the organization in which collaboration is considered not a byproduct, but an essential tool to how you're working together, working through things. And again, like I said, to me, the fundamental collaboration from a brand is the collaboration you're doing with the consumer, the person you're trying to build that loyal relationship with. So collaboration is hardwired into no matter how difficult it is, you have to work through it.
Cynthia, you mentioned a moment ago the importance of working with people who have perhaps different or conflicting perspectives. We are in a, one could argue, fairly polarized environment right now. And I've heard you talk on some other podcasts about the importance of working with people who are perhaps outside of your comfort zone, right? Maybe who don't have shared values or a similar point of view. Love your perspective on the importance and value of that and how one does that well.
Well, I think it's really what I was just talking about is probably at the heart of it. It has to do with innate curiosity in what other people think. Like, do you honestly care? And are you curious about another person's point of view? And then having respect. And of course, in these, I mean, I would not pretend to know how to bridge the gaps that we see in our country right now. I wish I did. I wish I knew what the secret to that was, because we certainly are in sore need of some solutions. But I do think, and I'm just kind of reiterating what I said before, I do think that respect and curiosity are at the heart of it. As individuals, we have to have that. As institutions, we have to have that. And there are moments, of course, when we have to agree to disagree. But when you are charged with trying to accomplish something specific, as I said, making, in the case of the Met, we've been talking about a more open and accessible place for people from all walks of life. When you've got that as a shared goal, you have no choice but to work through whatever the challenges are, because success depends on it. And so I think the clarity on vision, the willingness to go out of your comfort zone, as you said, I don't have the secret sauce for that, other than genuinely caring about what that other person thinks and knowing that we have to find some kind of common ground if we're going to be able to accomplish the goal together. And that's, you know, those kind of sound like platitudes, but that's actually, for me personally, that's what has worked. That and the willingness to always just be completely open and transparent about, you know, what I'm doing, what I'm thinking, laying it out there, not having a hidden agenda.
That makes total sense. Cynthia, you have given us quite a few gems here in terms of not just collaboration, but collaborative leadership, which I think is absolutely essential. And let's hope that a lot of our listeners are, to use your words, curious and excited to take forward some of these ideas and have that respect and get out of their comfort zone so that they can foster collaboration wherever they're coming from as well. So Cynthia Round, thank you so much for joining us. It's really been great fun having you on the show.
Well, thank you. It's a real pleasure. And I'm very excited for your next book.
Thank you.
Thank you, Cynthia. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
That was, in one word, extraordinary. I'm sitting here writing notes about how do we hardwire collaboration into the marrow of leaders of the future. I mean, that was just, I just appreciate so much what you said.
Yeah, and thank you, Cynthia, so much for giving those different examples and making it so specific and concrete and using storytelling as well as giving some advice. It was really a nice blend.
Oh, well, thank you. I felt like I was being a bit redundant. So
there's a lot of value actually in people hearing something in slightly different ways. Mm. Those are the core messages that you wanted to get across. And it wasn't redundant. It was reinforcing.
Okay, well, good. I, as you can probably tell, and you could see if you could see me, which I'm sorry you can't because I'm really not hiding, but somehow I didn't seem to activate my camera on this particular platform today. But I really believe everything that I was saying. I truly believe. And when I'm, when I'm out on the speaking circuit, I mean, I talk a lot, of course, since brand is my area, I mean, that's what I talk about. But I talk about going beyond relevant to irresistible. That's the title of the primary talk that I give. And I talk about that, this collaboration with consumers and this idea that the whole way, only way you can be successful as a brand is to truly understand how you're significant in their lives and then build that out. And that is a total immersive experience that you can only create in full collaboration with everyone inside your, inside and outside your organization that are going to touch that relationship. So to me, it is so authentically, it's like you can't be a successful brand marketer without authentic, deep collaboration. And of course, we all have brand visionaries that are, the ones that we think about that build great brands. But even with Steve Jobs is, then Apple's being the shining example of the brilliant brand and his vision. And we know what happens at times when he walked away from it and came back, and he drove that forward. But at the same time, Apple is such a great example of a fully immersive experience where everyone interprets that experience, right? And they're all collaborating in order to bring that to life and to sustain it over 40 years, right? So I so believe in my heart that collaboration is the essential agreement ingredient to anyone who's going to be a successful brand builder. That it was very easy for me to talk with you all about this today. I could go on and on, have many other examples from all my commercial brands, which we didn't get to, even, Pampers in Italy, as I said, or Mr. Clean, or any of my other beloved P&G brands.
Classic brands. That's great. Well, maybe we'll have another opportunity to hear some of those stories.
Exactly. Thank you again, Cynthia. So after each of these conversations, Ivan and I put our heads together and think about what we learned, what fresh insights have come up in the conversation, and what we hope some of the listeners will take away as well. So here's the first thing is, as I was listening to Cynthia's story about her time at the Met and how it really required people throughout every department and function and part of the Met to come together and live their fullest professional life to bring that mission to fruition. It reminded me of an experience I had when I was researching at the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. And Cynthia was talking about how vital it was to get the security guards at the Met in the spirit of inclusivity and welcoming and making
that first point of contact and experience.
Yeah, exactly. And it reminded me when I first started researching at the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, I pulled up to the building and a parking attendant came and grabbed my keys and sort of showed me where to go and when I dropped my parking ticket off later that day, I took the lift down to the parking garage and my car was waiting there for me. And I thought, wow, like they really know how to treat a first-time visitor. It was so smooth and easy and efficient. And then it happened again and again and again. And finally, I said to the parking attendant, you know, this is the best parking experience ever. And I had been looking around and there were no like cameras monitoring people. And I had tried to tip the guy and he wouldn't take any money from me. I just flat out said, you know, like, what's the deal? Like, why are you so good at parking people's cars? And he said something that stuck with me to this day. He said, you know, everyone who comes to the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, they either have cancer or they're visiting a loved one who does. He said, the last thing they should have to think about is parking their car. And it's just so striking that, you know, here's somebody, it is that first point of contact, but I'm afraid a lot of leaders today overlook those kinds of roles and jobs and functions, which aren't seen as sort of mission critical, but they are. They're absolutely vital. And, you know, the Dana-Farber did a brilliant job of making everyone who was employed or even the volunteers there understand how they were such a vital part of somebody's cancer journey. And then listening to Cynthia talk about how they did the same thing at the Met and really empowered people to bring that full experience. I think there's something there for leaders today.
Totally. She, you know, one of the themes I think cut through most of the examples that she shared was getting alignment on visions and goals, right? Having that sense of purpose of where you're going. And then, as you said, really empowering people to lead against that vision. We heard in our last podcast where we were talking about customer service in the eyeglass industry, right? About the power of enabling your frontline staff to make decisions and have the ability to do that, right? And how that really creates collaboration with the customers. So that I found that idea of really empowering people to execute on the vision to be very powerful.
100%. Absolutely. So, you know, we are so glad that everyone joined us today. Having Cynthia around here, we owe her a real debt of gratitude. I thought her stories and her insights were brilliant.
So why don't we wrap it up there? And for our parting words, remember, you may be able to go faster on your own, but you can go farther together.
We hope that you enjoyed this Smarter Collaboration episode. Thanks again to our very special guest, Cynthia Round, for joining us today. This show and series is produced by Success Made to Last Productions in Austin, Texas. Executive producer is Rick Tokini. And the show was co-written by Dr. Heidi Gardner, Ivan Matviak, Christine Dunn, and Rick Tokini. Post-production and sound design were led by Heather Barnes and Carlo Tokini. And our operations manager is Marie Ross. Until next time, we hope that you recognize ways to collaborate to enrich your life personally and professionally. Have a great week.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.